Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 16th. We are in Sefer Ezra. We are in Perek Beis Chapter 2. And tonight we'll be starting with Pasuk Nun Tes, verse 59. At least the last time, is that what we're saying? Okay, good. Couldn't figure out exactly what it was the last time. Okay, so we've been running, so we didn't go through it. We didn't read every single pasuk here because it's a lot of names. But we got the gist of it that Ezra is listing here the various groups of people that came up to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, at least the first attempt to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, with Zerubbabel, and with the other people that were listed before, and we've been going through the groups and who the groups were. And here we're going to see a new group that's going to be, or a new set of groups that are going to be listed. Now, the groups so far have been we've had Kohanim listed, we've had Levim, we had various cities, various places, various families. Okay, so now this pasuk, the Gemara takes the words of this pasuk, of this verse, breaks them down, breaks the words up, and understands that there are many groups that are being referred to in this one pasuk. So first let's read it. It's not going to read so easily. Let's read it and try to translate it. Ve'eva ha'olim mitel melach. These are the ones who came up from Tel Melach. Now Tel, what does Tel mean? Like Tel Aviv, what does Tel mean?
Mountain.
Okay.
Mountain.
It means hill. Or right. So Tel Melach, we write mountain. From Tel Melach, from the hill or rise of Melach. Melach means
salt.
So the salt hill, Tel Charsha, the Charsha hill, Choresh can mean to plow, can mean other things as well, Kruv Adon Amar, or actually I'm missing a vowel here, Kruv Adon, Imer, thank you, Kruv Adon Imer. Now those three words, how do they have it translated in one of your translations? They have
their names.
Okay, so it's names.
Yes.
Kruv Adon Imer. This is names. This is using just generic names. They were not able to tell their father's house and their lineage in the Yisraelim if they in fact were Jewish. These people had lost their yichus. They'd lost their lineage, and it was unclear whether they were Jewish or not. So the Gemara doesn't say specifically what might have happened, but it would be something along those lines. Now, as I said before, the Gemara breaks this pasuk up into several different groups.
Amen.
The Gemara says as follows. Tel Melach is a reference to those who whose behavior was similar to the place of salt.
Sidon.
To the place of salt, to Sidon. To their behavior was similar to that of Sidon. Which part of the behavior of Sidon is being referred to over here? We're not referring to theft or things of that nature, because here we're talking about families and the types of families that they are. And one of the things that Sidon was involved in was Gilui Arayos, was immorality. The Gemara, in contrasting the laws of Sidon, these were the laws on the books of Sidon, in contrasting that with the laws of the Torah, the Gemara says that, for example, and you'll excuse me because the example is not a nice one, if a man struck the pregnant wife of somebody else and caused a miscarriage,
it would be the one who committed the crime, the one who struck the woman, it will be his job to make sure that she becomes pregnant again. That was on the law of the book of Sodom. I'm trying to show you how corrupt and how perverted their laws were. But that was one of the laws of Sodom. It obviously has to be understood where would they come from, something like that, and how that, but that it doesn't make logical sense, that law. But that is the type of law they had. Obviously, that creates immorality and therefore leads to mamzerim, children who are born from a union that is prohibited, and they are mamzerim. So, yeah.
What was salty about them, about Sodom? Why are they called?
Because of the wife of Lot turning
up.
So the salt is a reference point of Sodom. That's right.
Did Lot's wife also ask people, "I need salt"? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So,
I'm saying, you're assuming that the woman that he hit was married?
Yeah, she was pregnant, so she was married. That was the presumption. So when it says Tel Melach, the hill of salt, it means the group of people who were mamzerim. That they were separated out because a mamzer is not where a mamzer is. A man or a woman who is a mamzer is not allowed to marry a regular born Jew. They can only marry either their own kind, which means someone else who is a mamzer, or they can marry someone who was not born Jewish. So a slave that was freed, a convert, they can marry a mamzer or a mamzeris. But someone who was born Jewish cannot marry a mamzer or a mamzeris. So it is important to know which group are mamzerim. As we said, that they were separated out, that Ezra, even though this is not Ezra's doing, but as I mentioned to you, that Ezra went to great length to find out who was who amongst the Jewish people. And this is the beginning of that identification process. Later on it will be completed when Ezra actually goes with them up to Yerushalayim. The next thing, Tel Harsha, is another group of people. Although Choresh means to plow, a Cheresh is someone who is deaf. It's called a Cheresh. And in the language of the Torah and of the Gemara, a Cheresh is not a deaf, it's a deaf mute. So what is that referring to? It's not referring to a physical disability. It's referring to somebody who knows who his mother is, but does not know who his father is. That the father is unknown. That category in the language of the Mishnah is called shtuki, from the word shtok. Shtok means quiet. Where the child, the way that Rashi explains it over there is, the child calls for his father, and the mother says quiet, because we don't know who it is. That is the category of telcharsha, of those who are mute, meaning they don't know who their father is. And since they don't know who their father is, they are a suffix. They are in doubt whether they are a mamzer or not. Because we don't know who the father is. At least, though, we know that they're Jewish. Because the mother's Jew. We know who the mother is. I'm going to skip ahead over here, because we'll come back to these words in a minute. But, citizens. But then it says, they couldn't tell their father's house and their lineage if they are Jews. That's a third category, and that's the category the Mishnah calls Asufi. Asufi means gathered in, which means a child, an infant, that was discovered in the market, that we have no idea. Not only are we not sure who the father is, we don't know who the mother is either, and therefore we don't even know if they're Jewish. And that is a third category called Asufi. All these groups, the Mamzer group, the Shtuki group is the group that we know the mothers but not the father, and the Asufi group, where we don't even know who the mother is, those groups all have restrictions on who they can marry and who can marry them. What about those words we skipped? Kruv, Idan, I'm sorry, Kruv, Adon Imer. So here the Gemara uses these words. Somebody said before Kruv would be from the word cherub, a Kruv. So the Gemara says that Hashem says, Imer's Hashem says, I said that these people, these Jewish people, should be like Kruvim. They should be like cherubs. They should be pure. There should be no doubts about them. That's what I said about the Jewish people. But unfortunately, they have, due to their indiscretion in their relationships, they have created children that are not the way that I expected them to be. The Gemara presents this in two ways. One, as a lament, the way I just said it, and the other as Hashem saying, my love for them endures despite the fact that they did not live up to the standards that I set. They still are in my eyes like Kruvim, even though they did not maintain their discretion in how they built relationships. So that is how the Gemara breaks down this pasuk. Now, I want to share with you that this is just an interesting...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can.
Why would that phrase be inserted between...
I don't know. That's a good question. That's a very good question. You would expect it to come at the end. Right. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer. I thought about that, but I don't have a good answer.
Because the series actually goes in order. The first group being, you know the mother, you know the father, and presumably they're both Jewish, but they're not married. And the second one is, you know the mother, and she's Jewish, but you don't know the father. And then you've got this little insertion, and that's followed by, you don't know the mother or the father.
Right. That's right.
Declining order.
That's right.
That's the three-word insertion.
Right. So I'm not sure why it's put there. I'm not sure it's why it's put there, although it could be because the last group, you don't even know if they're Jewish, and Hashem only says the Kruvim part about those who are definitely Jewish. It could be that that's what it has to do with.
What is Adon?
I'm not sure. Okay. I'm not sure.
Doesn't come from Adon, master?
No. Oh, that's right. Thank you.
Adon Olam?
Yeah. It could be that's what the Gemara says. I didn't remember. It could be that's what the Gemara says. The master said they should be like Kruvim. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Good. Now, I want to read to you something that actually Rabbi Freilich forwarded to me. The headline is, this is from when? This is from only a few days ago. The headline is, expectant South African couple discover that they are brother and sister. An engaged South African couple expecting their first child, that's their first mistake, have found out they are actually brother and sister. The unmarried couple made a shocking discovery when their families met to discuss marriage arrangements ahead of their baby's birth next month, the whatever reported Thursday, I don't know how to pronounce that word. Neither knew that they had a sibling as they were brought up separately following their parents' acrimonious split.
Oh, awful.
Right. The girl was raised by her mother, the boy by his father. They were brought together for the first time to observe the traditional South African custom of whatever. And they said it was love at first sight. Right.
She's on wedding expense.
When I first saw him, we connected, the woman said. We fell in love, and since then we never looked back. All I wanted to do was just have a family and many kids. Okay. So when the Gemara discusses these groups, one could have argued that someone who we don't know who their mother is or their father is, or both, should be prohibited from marrying anybody because you don't know who their relatives are, not just siblings, because people are prohibited to their siblings, people are prohibited to their parents, to their most of their aunts and uncles. There's only an uncle and a niece can marry, but other than that, there's a prohibition. There's many types of incest that could take place, and we should therefore prohibit them from marrying anybody. So the Gemara says, for that, we do not prohibit them. Because there, we have the concept of rove, of the majority. The vast majority of who they would marry are not going to be their siblings. This is a needle in a haystack type of thing, the article I just read to you. And therefore, we're not concerned about that happening. However, the likelihood that there is a mamzer here is very strong. And that's why we don't let them marry anybody except whom a mamzer can marry.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's
not
interesting.
In certain places,
it's a modern problem. Mm-hmm. And I once looked into adoption.
I was about to bring that up. Go ahead.
You can explain it then.
Well, no, the adoption laws in America.
Well, what I read was that a Jewish couple should not adopt a child that was born Jewish, that it was better to adopt one that was not born from a Jewish mother and then raise the child Jewish so that it was less likely that that child might end up marrying
a child. They recommend that if a woman needs a surrogate, they get it going.
Well, when you say they, the opinion you just mentioned is only one opinion. There is a very strong counter opinion that says that one should definitely adopt Jewish because we have an obligation to take care of our own Jewish children. So a Jewish orphan should definitely be taken care of. So there is a very strong opinion the other way. But the laws of adoption in America are such that you can't necessarily find out who the biological parents are. And that is a problem. In Jewish law, there's adoption in Jewish law, but in Jewish law, it's the reverse. We want to know everything. I don't think it's actually termed HIPAA, but the similar type of laws with the adoption, the privacy laws, are such that you can only find out the medical records of the child. You cannot find out the biological records of the child because as far as the government is concerned, there's no reason for you to know it. What difference does it make? As long as you know the medical records, that's important. You have to, and medical records include medical history. So is there a history of heart disease in this family? That you're allowed to find out. But who the family is, you can't find out. We would say just the opposite. It's very important to know who the family is because of these issues, that you don't end up with some sort of an incest problem.
In modern times, you also have the problem that even if the mother is Jewish or the mother is not Jewish, two generations before, because there is no line like the book says right here.
Right.
So two generations before in Poland, they could have been Jewish and they came to America and are no longer Jewish. So it's a problem at many levels.
Right, and it gets worse as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share, since we're picking up so much time, I think many years ago, 20, 30 years ago, I happened to meet a woman. She was not a servant, but we started talking once, and she shared with me that she found out after her father passed away, her mother informed her that the man, the local grocer, who was friendly with the family, actually was her biological father, and that she herself was a momser. That the mother had not wanted to tell her while her husband was still alive.
Right.
And I
agree. And these things are, yeah. Now,
can you repeat, so why did Ezra, just these three, because they have their lineage?
They can't marry a born Jew.
Okay.
Now, this actually has a tie-in to this week's parsha, believe it or not. It actually has relevance to this week's parsha. Abraham sends Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzchak. Now, you may be familiar with the story that he sends Eliezer, and Eliezer comes and finds Rivka at the well. Perfect. Wonderful shidduch. And then he goes and meets the family. That's where things go downhill a little bit. And he's introduced to Lavan and to Bethuel. And then the Medrash tells us that they tried to poison Eliezer. They tried to kill him. And a malach came and changed the portions around, and instead Besuel ate from the poisoned food and died. There's a Gemara that says that if a person, you know that, even though this takes the romance out of it, but one can get married using an agent.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when you go to a wedding, so you have a bride and groom there, neither the bride nor the groom have to be there. The groom can send an agent, and the bride can send an agent. In other words, the groom's agent can take a ring and put it on the finger of the bride's agent and say, the words would be something along the lines of, that my good friend who sent me here is with this ring, your good friend who sent you here should be married to him.
Mm-hmm.
And gives her the ring, and it works. As I said, it takes the whole romance out of it. I don't know what Rabbi Shlomo would say on the chuppah. It was all about the two people. But it is halakhically possible to do that. You don't need to have the bride and groom in the same place in order to have a Jewish wedding. Eliezer, according to some opinions, Eliezer was Yitzchak's agent to actually marry Rivka for him. Now, the agent is just, it's like any other transaction. If I want to, if you and I are involved in any kind of monetary transaction, I don't have to give you the money, I can just not have to give you the money. That's what's happening over here, that Yitzchak gives the ring to Eliezer, Eliezer goes and gives the ring to Rivka. Okay, they're married. So some opinions say that that's what was going on, that Eliezer was actually the agent to marry Rivka to Yitzchak. Now, there is a Gemara that says that it's okay to send an agent to marry somebody on your behalf, for you. As a man has to send someone to put the ring on the bride's finger. That's fine. But what if somebody sends an agent and says, I am empowering you to find me a wife, you make the choice, and then put the ring on her finger on my behalf. But I don't know who it's going to be. It's your choice. That's what's happening over here, right? Yitzchak didn't know who Eliezer was going to find. So what if a person does that? And then the agent dies.
Before or after he puts the ring on?
Let's assume after. We don't know.
Oh, the agent dies.
He never comes back.
Oh, wow. You don't know who you're married to.
Does he trust? He doesn't know who he's married to.
He doesn't know who he's married to.
He can't marry anyone until he knows for sure.
So the Gemara says he's prohibited from marrying anybody in the world. Because the woman who he wants to marry, no, not polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
The woman he wants to marry might be his wife's sister.
Mm-hmm.
Or his wife's mother. Or his wife's daughter. The woman who he's married to, he doesn't know. So the woman who he is trying to marry now, he meets somebody else and falls in love and says, I want to marry you. Maybe she's actually the sister, the mother of the woman who his agent already married him to. So it becomes a nightmare. Now, the Gemara says that in truth, using the principle of rove, of the majority, that shouldn't be an issue. But over here, because the person acted irresponsibly, he should not have sent an agent in that way, with that kind of power, and with the risk of not ever finding out what the agent did. Therefore, the person, according to some opinions, is prohibited from marrying anybody in the world.
Obviously before cell phones, because she's got blonde hair and blue eyes.
That family
got a hypocrite
to her.
That's right.
So someone is... Now, listen how it comes full circle. So there is an approach that wants to suggest that when Besuel and Lavan tried to murder Eliezer, they weren't just trying to murder Eliezer. They were trying to prohibit Yitzchak from ever marrying.
Would Rivka have the same thing then, right? She couldn't marry anyone else.
Well, she would know who the person was. She couldn't marry anybody else, right, because she'd be married. She'd be a married woman. But they were trying to prohibit Yitzchak from ever marrying, in which case that would prohibit, that would preempt the Jews ever coming into existence. Because if Yitzchak never marries, then there is no Jewish people. And that, and that would be what it means when we say in the Haggadah that they wanted to destroy, they wanted to destroy everything. Arami Oved Avi, that he was trying to destroy everything. There are many, many explanations for when did Lavan try to kill all the Jewish people. And this is one of the more creative answers to that question. That here in this episode, in this week's parasha, by trying to kill Eliezer and thereby prohibiting Yitzchak from marriage, that would have effectively destroyed the Jews, because the Jews never would have been able to come into existence. That is just a creative way. Yeah, you can poke holes in it if you want to really think about it. It's an interesting approach, which ties together what we're talking about here with this week's parasha. And with that, we're going to move on. Yes.
What was Laban's personality like? He was very smart, like a horrible man. Very smart, horrible man.
Okay. There's been a lot of smart, horrible people.
Yeah. So how did he know, how did he know that the Jewish people?
Well, he wouldn't have called it the Jewish people. He would have called it the creation of a nation coming from Avraham and Yitzchak.
So he knew, he had prophecy that he knew what was coming.
He knew. Some say that Lavan was Bilam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then he had an idea
of it. Also, I mean, Abraham was part of the family.
Yeah, they were family members.
Family,
yeah.
And he cut off the
whole
lineage.
Well, he was the brother-in-law.
Okay, that's true. What's that?
He was the brother-in-law.
Well, Bethuel was the...
married the daughter of Nahor.
Yeah. Well, no. Bethuel was born to Nahor and Milcah. Nachar, Avram's brother, and Milcah, Sarah's sister, had several children. One of them was Bethuel.
Mm. Oh,
down, that's right. Mm. Pasuk Mem, verse 40, Samach, verse 60. So here we have a few more names. B'nai Deloya, B'nai Tovia, B'nai Nekoda, the children of these families, Deloya, Tovia, Nekoda, Sheish Miras Kamishim Ushnaim, 652. Umibnei HaKohanim, and from the children of the Kohanim, B'nai Chavaya, the children of Chavaya, B'nai HaKotz, the children of the Kotz, B'nai Barzilai, and the children of Barzilai, Ashalakach mibenos Barzilai Hagiladi Isha, that took from the daughters of Barzilai Hagiladi a wife, Bayikare al Shemam, and they were called on his name. Who is Barzilai Hagiladi? Anybody know?
Familiar,
right? David is right. But I didn't hear the rest of it.
No,
that's Aravna. But Barzilai. Right. But Barzilai is with David. Barzilai was a non-Jew who helped David during the rebellion of Avshalom, of his son.
And we tell Shlomo that he has relationship.
That's right. So on David's deathbed, he tells Shlomo, his son, the various things he has to do, mm-hmm. certain people who he has to take care of by getting rid of them. And he tells him, Barzilai Hagiladi, you should take care of. Have him eat at your table. And the children of Barzilai, you know, you should always care for him and for his children, have him eat at your
was
table.
Was his son lame?
What's that?
Whose son was lame? Was that Barzilai's son?
No. There was one of the slaves. His son was lame. There's somebody else. Tziva.
Okay.
Now, actually, not one of the slaves. Sorry. Tziva's owner. Right. What's that? Right. The Fiboshes was lame. That's right. Tziva's owner was lame. So that's who Barzilai is. So Barzilai is remembered, Zachor L'Tov, he's remembered for good because he helped David out. And his children apparently converted and became Jews. And those who married into his family, even though they were marrying his daughters, or it doesn't mean daughters, it can mean granddaughters, but it means the females of his family, they took his name, Barzilai, because of how high regard he was held. However, this list ends up being another category because it says in Samach Beis in 62, Eile bikshu ksavam hamesyachsim. These families sought after, they searched for their
lineage,
their family trees. Felonim so, they couldn't find it. They could not establish with certainty that they were Kohanim. They tried to, but could not establish with certainty that they were Kohanim. And therefore, vayagalu min ha-kuhuna, they were distanced from the kuhuna, from the priesthood. So let's explain this first of all. We know that there are many people today who are Kohanim. We also know that today very few people can trace their family tree with certainty back that far. There's been too much upheaval amongst our people, and as a result, it's very hard to trace lineage back. Now, if you're not a Kohen, okay, so, you know, as long as you know that you're Jewish, and we have a chazaka, we have a presumption that a person whose parents are Jewish, grandparents are Jewish, they're Jewish all the way back. We don't ask questions. But if someone who is a Kohen, if they don't have a way of tracing themselves back, there's always the possibility they're not really Kohanim. And the major way that that would affect anything today, because what does it matter whether you're a Kohen or not today? So one thing it matters for is getting the first Aliyah. All right, so if the person isn't really a Kohen, gets the first Aliyah, Mishka Frelich, it's not a big deal. Another way that it affects things is duchening, is when the Kohanim bench us, when they give us a bracha. So, what's that? Okay, to leave the benching. These things are all... Okay, so I'll get to that in a moment. So, duchening is a little bit more serious because a Kohen that is in shul and does not go up when they're supposed to go up, he is, under most circumstances, but frequently he is transgressing because he has an obligation to bless the Jewish people. And if a non-Kohen goes up, so it's not a transgression except for saying the bracha, which is wrong, but they're not getting any bracha. Because in order to get a bracha, you have to be in front of the Kohanim, or in the general front of the Kohanim. But if you're standing there with the Kohanim, you don't get the bracha. So it's he's losing out on getting the bracha by going up there if he's not really a Kohen. Okay.
What if he's the only one that claims to be a Kohen, and he's the only one going up there, so
okay.
There's no...
Right, it shouldn't be done, but it's not the end of the world. It means that there's a bracha that shouldn't be said. That's a problem. But the actual duchening, okay. But the real problem is pinyon haben. Pinyon haben, redemption of the firstborn, that a family that both the father and mother are not Kohanim or Levim, both the father and mother are Yisraelim, and there's a firstborn male, and there were no miscarriages, and the boy was not born through a C-section. If all those parameters are met, then they have to perform a pinyon haben, which means that they have to give five shkalim, the Torah's coins, to a Kohen, any Kohen. How much is five shkalim? Five shkalim is roughly, according to the Chazon Ish, there's different opinions, is the weight of, it's the value of 95 grams of silver. 95 grams of silver on the silver market, whatever the price of silver is in your day. Today, the price of silver is much higher than it normally is. It has spiked, as all precious metals of late, so it's much higher. Today, at today's prices, pinyon haben is probably right around $100. When I did a pinyon haben for my son 18 years ago, it was roughly $25. So it's like it may have been even less than that. It may have been more like
$15. Didn't they save us a bill in the gun or something?
Yeah. So, now, you can give the money to any Kohen, but until you give money to the Kohen, you have to do it on the 30th day or later, preferably on the 31st day. But if you don't give the money to the Kohen, then the person is not redeemed, and the mitzvah is not being performed. If you give the money to someone who claims to be a Kohen but really isn't, then the mitzvah has not been performed, and the child is not redeemed. So when people perform a pinyon haben today, it is preferable, if possible, to find a Kohen who has a shtar yichus, who has a family tree that dates him back far enough that we can be certain the person is a Kohen. There have been several stories of people who thought they were Kohanim and discovered later that they are not Kohanim. And similarly with Levium, it has happened. It is not such an uncommon thing. You never hear about it. I've heard, I'm not that old, I've heard in my own experience, a handful of both Kohanim and Levium who ended up not being Kohanim and Levium. They discovered later that it was not so. People get confused. A very simple way that it can happen to get confused is something which my grandfather, Olav Hashem, his family did, his great-grandfather, in order to avoid being taken into the Russian army, my great-grandfather exchanged papers with someone who was deceased. So my great-grandfather, who was a Levi, my mother is a Bas Levi, he was a Levi, his last name was Horowitz, which is a very common Levi name, and he became Minkoff, or Minkovich, Minkoff, which is not a very common Levi name, but that happened because he changed papers. So it can happen, but people get confused. We have a Horowitz in our community who's a Kohen, even though Horowitz is normally a Levi name. There are people whose last name is Kohen, they're not Kohanim. They're not Kohanim.
Not even Jewish.
Okay, that's even worse. There was a family in a Persian family in Baltimore. I was actually very friendly with him. He was a neighbor of ours, a Persian family. They had one of these. Unpronounceable names. You know, one of these really, really long, impossible to spell Persian names. Right. Well, worse than that. So he changed his name to Levin. He liked the name. He's not a lazy. He liked the name. So he changed the name to Levin. Right?
When we were in college, there was a guy from Iran, and he showed me. He had his lineage where he could go all the way back to Aaron HaKohen. They kept it, and that's what he came out of Iran with. He didn't take the money or whatever. I don't think he could. But he came out with the lineage because that's what...
Okay,
important.
So for Pinnon HaBen, that lineage is significant. If a person can find that is significant. Rabbi Mordechai Cohen here has a family tree that goes all the way back. When I did Pinnon HaBen in Baltimore, so we used Rabbi Rosen in Baltimore, who did not have the Shtar Yichus, didn't have the family. His family did not have one because when they fled Europe right before the war, they were unable to bring anything with them, and they did not bring the Shtar Yichus. They had one in Europe, but when they escaped, I believe they were from Germany, I think they're Yankees, they were not able to bring the document with them. Mm-hmm. But when they got out of Europe, one of the first things they did is they took two witnesses who met the criteria for being kosher witnesses, who had seen the Shtar, obviously not their own family members, other people who had seen the document, and they testified that they saw the document, and they wrote another document testifying that they had seen the document. So that they have. That's very rare.
Right. And would it have been, would it be possible if someone had doubt to give money to a legitimate Kohen now on their own behalf, or once it's done?
No, you can do it again. Just don't say a bracha. But it can be done again. And the story goes that the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, he himself was a Bechor, he was a firstborn. His father did it for him when he was, 31 days old. But when he became an adult, he did it more times until he found a Kohen that he felt he could be sure was a Kohen. So that becomes an issue. So here, these Kohanim in Ezra, this list over here, they were not able to establish their lineage, which was more unusual in their day. In our day, it's very common not to be able to establish your lineage. In their day, people knew where they came from, even though they had gone through the upheaval of an exile, but it was only a 70-year exile, not thousands of years. And throughout the first Beit HaMikdash, the records were kept very carefully. So the most people were able to trace themselves back. They could not, and therefore they were unable to be full-fledged Kohanim. They couldn't do everything. The Gemara says they were able to continue eating the various types of not real truma, not truma that we'll call it the Torah requirement of truma, but the rabbinic requirements of truma they were able to eat. Since they were presumed to be kohanim, they could still do that, but they were not able to work in the Beis HaMikdash once it would be rebuilt. Yeah.
What happens if the reverse happens? Somebody doesn't know what they are, right? The family treats them up. They redeem their firstborn
son.
And they find out later that they were Boscoe and Beth later, that it was a Cohen or later.
Did they get their money back?
No. Yeah. I mean, the son was redeemed, but shouldn't have been redeemed.
Right.
Is that a problem? Or
It's not a problem. The only issue will be, do they get their money back? That'll be the issue.
The Cohen spent it already.
Right, it's gone, right.
There's no marriages that are prohibited to the Cohen.
Yeah, so in this case, they would not be allowed to marry someone who is prohibited to a kohen because they were presumed to be kohanim, but they couldn't establish the lineage 100%. So they would have to be machmir, they have to be stringent, and not marry someone that a kohen could not marry. In the case that Mrs. Lewis just mentioned, yeah, that would end up being an issue. If they were married to someone that a kohen couldn't marry, and then they discovered they're a kohen,
right,
that can be a real issue. So, and then we hope things like that don't happen. That's a very sad story that happens. Yeah.
We're the only people, the Jewish people, that do this lineage, because I've never heard of other nations do that.
I don't know. I don't know if it matters as much, but I mean, they used to have royalty. That's right. The royalty did it. That was a big deal.
But the royalty, that is very messed up. If you look at the family tree, so fast. That this was their child, but it was really, they're so clean in the family, in the royal one.
What's important to them is what they record, and those things are not important to them.
Right, right.
And also took people off the family tree. They didn't like them.
Yeah, they were not supposed to be home.
That's right.
It's not that, it's just to phone them. They erased them from the Bible.
Samech Gimel 63, Vayomer Hatirshasa Lahem. Hatirshasa, I'll tell you what that is in a minute, said to these Kohanim who could not establish their lineage, Asher lo yochlu mikodesh hakadoshim. They cannot eat from the sanctified food. They can't eat from the karbanos. Ad amod kohen l'urim ulisumim. Until a kohen gets up for the urim v'tumim. What is the urim v'tumim? Okay, so it's not the breastplate, although it is, that's where it's housed, but it's the parchment with God's name that is inside the breastplate, which causes the breastplate to light up when a question is posed to the Kohen. He can ask, and the letters light up that need to give the answer. It was a prophetic sort of thing. So Hatir Shasta said to them, your families cannot partake of karbanos that are for a Kohen only, until a Kohen gets up who is wearing the Urim and the Tumim. That means when Mashiach comes. Because they didn't have the Urim and the Tumim in the second Beis HaMikdash. That's one of the things they didn't have. The second Beis HaMikdash paled in comparison to the first. We will talk about that extensively when we get to that discussion. And one of the things that was lacking in the second Beis HaMikdash was they did not have the Urim and the Tumim. They didn't have that parchment. They did have the breastplate, but they didn't have the parchment that would go inside. And therefore, it did not light up, and they didn't have any way of accessing that sort of prophecy. And so finding out who really is a Kohen and who is not will have to wait, says Hatir Shasa, until Mashiach comes.
Is that Mordechai
Tir Shasa? No, no. I'll tell you in a minute. But before that, we know that when Mashiach comes, then our families will get reestablished. We'll find out where we come from. There is a discussion in the Gemara just how detailed it's going to be, meaning there may be certain facts that we don't want to find out, right? So whether all the information is going to be laid bare or whether it's just going to be general information of, you know, what tribe are you from and that kind of thing, that's a discussion in the Gemara. I can't tell you the answer because there are different opinions, and we'll find out hopefully soon. So, but there certainly will be some element of finding out where we belong, in which tribe, you know, maybe we'll find out some of us are Kohanim when we didn't realize it, you know, so that kind of thing. That will take place when Mashiach comes. And that's what Hatir Shasa is saying. Who is Hatir Shasa? Nehemiah. That's right. Hatir Shasa is Nehemiah. Nehemiah, who we already mentioned before, is Zerubbabel. So here we have another name for Nehemiah, and that is Hatir Shasa. Why was his name Hatir Shasa? Because Nehemiah had a very special job. His job, considered to be a very prestigious position in the Persian government, and that is that he was the steward of the king, that he served the king his drink. He would be the steward, the wine steward of the king. Now, the wine steward of the king has a very dangerous job.
You can't drink it first.
Yes, he has to drink it first.
That's right.
He has to take a sip first. And if he survives, then the king drinks. So Nehemiah Hatir Shasa had to drink first. Okay, fine. So it's a dangerous job. The problem is that it's not just dangerous. It ought to be a prohibited job. Because what's the issue with wine? What do we know about wine and non-Jews? Wine is the there are certain things that are not kosher because the ingredients are not kosher. The ingredients are not kosher. There are certain things that are not kosher, not because the ingredients are not kosher, but because even though the ingredients are kosher, but the way that they are handled makes them not kosher. So we know that under certain circumstances, a meal cooked by a non-Jew is prohibited, even though all the ingredients are kosher, because of bishulakum, because of the cooking of a non-Jew. There are very intricate rules over there, and let's not get bogged down in the details of that, because that can be a whole class in and of itself. But we know that there is such a concept. The item that is most sensitive to becoming not kosher, even though the ingredient is kosher, is wine. Wine has the greatest propensity for becoming not kosher because there is a rabbinic decree against all wine that is not that it's prepared by a non-Jew or cooked by a non-Jew, but rather touched or handled by a non-Jew makes the wine not kosher. Now, it's true that once the wine is cooked by a Jew, then the wine handled by a non-Jew is okay. And that's why most of the wines sold on the market today are mevushal, are cooked, which prevents this problem. But in their day, the wine was not cooked. The wine was always pure. It would have been an inferior wine if it was cooked. It was considered to be an inferior wine. The taste would have been diminished. They were very particular. The wines were always raw, not cooked. And so here, if he is serving the king the wine, but he needs to sip first, that means he has to drink not kosher wine. Now, it's rabbinically not kosher. It's not prohibited from the Torah. It's rabbinic, but it is prohibited. So the Chachamim got together in his day, the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, those the men of the Great Assembly, who led the Jewish people at that time, they got together, recognizing that it was important that Nehemiah have that position. Nehemiah, remember, is a descendant of David HaMelech, of King David, so he represents royalty for the Jewish people, even though we didn't have a king, we would not have a king during the second Beis HaMikdash. But he represented the royal line for the Jewish people, which means if he has this, what is considered to be a very lofty post in the Persian government, that means the Persian government is recognizing the Jewish royal line. That's very, very significant. That's a major step forward from the Babylonian era when the Jewish royal line was in a pit in the ground and kept in bondage. So they recognized that it was important to maintain this position, and they got together and they rescinded the rabbinic decree against non-Jewish wine for Nehemiah. A special dispensation just for him, that they were able to, because it's only rabbinic, so they're able to rescind it. And they rescinded it, and he was permitted to drink it. That's why his name is Hatir Shasa, from the word Shasa, which means to drink.
Wow.
And from the word Tirosh, which means wine. Tirosh is wine. We say it in Kriya Shema, and the wine company Tirosh means wine. So he was given permission to drink the wine. That's why his name was Hatir Shasta. The question?
You mentioned that during the Second Temple that we didn't have the parchment.
Yes.
So didn't he know what was in the parchment? Why couldn't he?
No, because they didn't know the name. That was the name of Hashem that we're not familiar with. It wasn't just the four-letter name of Hashem that we know.
So we lost that?
Yes.
We don't know that.
Right. We don't know it today.
And that's made it.
At least I don't know. Yeah. Right. So they didn't know it, so they couldn't write it and put it in. Right. That's the shame on the forash. But whatever that name is, that's a powerful name, they didn't have it anymore. It was lost.
This dispensation for him to drink was political. Seems like it was more of a political move.
That's right. That's right.
In order to assist the Jewish people.
That's right. That's right. If you want to find a source for being active politically, this is a good source. Right? You see that they recognize that as an important thing. Now, we don't have the luxury of rescinding decrees because there are actually several limitations that we have. One limitation that we have is that our sages today are not accomplished as the sages who made the decree. And in order to rescind the decree, you have to be at least as great as those who made the decree. And we're so much later in history, we've diminished so much, even though our sages are pretty great, but they're not like they were. So we don't have any prophets, and we don't have that. So we can't rescind decrees today. Moreover, in order to rescind the decree, you really needed a consensus. And if there's one thing that we have problems with today, consensus. So we don't have the luxury of rescinding decrees, but they were able to do it, and they recognized the need to do it for Nehemiah, for Zerubbabel, and he got that dispensation, and he was called Hatir Shasta for that reason.
Who called him that?
What's that? Well, I don't know who gave him the name, but Ezra uses it over here, and it's going to be used more than once. It's not the only time this is going to be used. But thank you. You're right. My brother-in-law he lobbies for the Aguda in the Midwest, Rabbi Motzen. So I have to tell him about this. Is it a nice source for what he's doing? Very good. Okay. Okay. Let's go a little further. Psalm 64. Kol ha'kahal ke'echad. The entire group together. If you go back and count all the numbers, Arba Ribo, 40,000, Alpayim, 2,000, Shlosh Meos Shishin, 360, 42,360. Now, if you add it all up before, you're only going to get around 33,000. You're not going to get 40. You're not going to get this. You're going to be a little short on the number. So the Gemara explains that the numbers before were for the families that were primarily from Yehuda. And from, primarily from Yehuda. This, the other several thousand were from the other tribes that weren't listed before. And then the pasuk continues in 65, Samechei, Melvad Avdehem V'am Hosein, Eileh, besides, not including, their male servants and female servants, Shivas Alafim, there were 7,000 of them, Shlosh Meos Shloshim V'Shiva, 7,337, to Lahem, and they also had Mishorim u'Mishororos Masayim, 200 musicians. So in addition to all the numbers we had before, you have another 7,000 and change, plus a couple of hundred musicians. The total, if you add it all up, is going to be around 50,000. Why musicians? Because since they were going from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael for the purpose of building the Beis HaMikdash, it was a festive, joyous time, and they brought along musicians to play along the way to make it a festive trip up to Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't the... Right. It was to drown out the children from saying, are we there yet? So,
weren't they all forced? Wasn't this the group that was forced to go back?
Well, there was some of them, there was a discussion whether they were forced or not, but not all of them were forced. Some were forced. Now, we'll talk about it more extensively later. The 50,000 total is very little.
Mm-hmm.
It's very little compared to the total number of Jews. I don't know how many Jews there were at that time, but it was way more than 50,000. So it is an established fact that the amount of Jews that left Bavel to go to Eretz Yisrael to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash was low. And it could have been higher. And it was low. And that
usually there's a 20% number. You know, like 20% of us left.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know.
Could it have been?
Yeah, it could have been. I don't know.
Or is that not?
I don't know. I have no idea what the number is. But I do know that this was a low number.
So
yeah. Yeah.
Could musicians coming along to play music was to kind of put in the same frame of mind as Shlomo, because that was also festive time.
Could be.
When people went up to other radio.
It could be.
You know, festiveness and music also, I think.
It could be. It could be that it's
how many of these were like of the age that they could actually labor to build a Beis HaMikdash?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, they had laborers. We're going to see that there were many laborers.
Besides the servants.
Yeah. No, they were working. They came up with the intention of building.
So Rabbi Yavish had given them money?
Yeah, there's money, there's provisions, right? Now remember, it's going to be stopped. They're not going to get that far. But this is the first time. Yeah. Yeah.
The musicians were badly?
Were?
Badly?
I assume so. I mean, were they Jews or not, you're asking?
Yeah.
I'm assuming they were Jewish. I'm assuming they were Jewish. But they're
they're now Levian.
Not necessarily Levian.
Because when we went into Boston, there was an opening with Levian who said they can't sing Shira.
Right, that's right. There were those who...
We're not saying that those Levian are now singing Shira, they're going back.
Okay, so that's a good point. That's a good point. We're going to talk about those Levian. Actually, did I forget to speak about them? We brought it up before? We're going to talk about those Levian. I may have forgotten to mention it, but there would be children born in Bavel also. And the ones who came from Yerushalayim 70 years ago, you're right, they would have been now handicapped. But the ones who were born later, they were, right? So, yeah.
Why are females in this?
Well, they may have been musicians. I don't know about they sang, right? Right. Well, it is song. I mean, the word comes from the word song, but it doesn't necessarily, when the Gemara uses the word song, it doesn't always mean to sing verbally. Right.
You need music if you want to increase your nevuah.
That's true.
Maybe
that's
part of the reason.
That could
mean.
Be. It could be. Like, I mean, the age of prophecy was coming to an end. It's waning at this point. Okay, so we'll pick it up next time. So I thought we were going to finish the parak today, but we'll pick it up from Samachah 66.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.